Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the September's issue of Good Housekeeping magazine. Our first article is called Slash Your Pet Care Costs. If you're like most pet owners, you treat your furry friend as well as, if not better, than yourself. A recent poll of female shoppers found that while 68% of women were willing to switch brands of their over-the-counter medications and certain staples to save cash, only 29% would change their brand of pet food. And the American Pet Products Association forecasts that total pet spending in 2009 will reach $45.4 billion. Given the state of the economy, that tells you a lot about how Fido and Fluff Mums gets treated. But just because you want to give your pets the best doesn't mean you have to sit back and watch your bills escalate. Instead, try these smart tips for spending less while still showering them with love. Step 1. Lower food cost. If you can't see or easily feel your pet's ribs, he could probably stand to shed a few pounds. And if so, he's hardly alone. Some 44% of dogs and 50% of cats in America are overweight. If a medical condition isn't to blame, you may be unintentionally overfeeding. Most pet food label feeding guides are based on the caloric needs of an unneutered, unspayed, active adult animal, explains the veterinarian Ernie Ward, president of the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention. A spayed or neutered pet's metabolic needs are 25 to 30% lower than that. Go to the PetObesityPrevention.com to learn your critter's true caloric needs. Then feed the lowest recommended amount on your pet food package. If your pet stays at a healthy weight, you may help him avoid diabetes, kidney disease, and other ailments, and you'll definitely save cash. Say you pay $30 for a 17.5-pound bag of Nutra Adult Dog dry food. The feeding guide for a 40-pound dog recommends 1 3/4 cups to 3 1/3 cups daily. Feed the lower amount and you'll save about $210 a year. Will pets complain about getting less food? You bet your last kibble. There's a strong behavioral component to overeating, says Ward. To survive the pleading odds, Ward advised playing with your pet. By rewarding begging with physical and emotional interaction, pet owners will soon see an improvement. Supplement wisely with scraps. Think twice before you toss your leftovers. They could stretch your pet's diet. We keep a container in the refrigerator and add things like chopped broccoli, green beans, meatloaf, and scrambled eggs. Then we mix it with a high-quality dog food, says Liz Jenkins of Nashville. We cut our pet food cost in half, and our dog loves it, and she's fit and trim. A smart move, according to Babette Gladstein, a veterinarian in the Be Glad Veterinary Services in New York. But don't just treat your pet like a garbage disposal with a tail. Rather, feed her as if she was your 90-year-old grandmother. No spices, no dairy. Be careful with fat. Most lean meats and fish are good, as well as vegetables. Start your pet on a small amount of food, and if she reacts well, incorporate more of it into her diet, up to 50% of her meals. Some human foods are toxic to animals, so see the list at goodhousekeeping.com/pet. If you don't already buy your pet food at warehouse clubs, start now. At Costco, we found a case of 22-ounce cans of Pedigree Chunky Beef Dog Food for $24.99 versus $33.36 at a local supermarket. Advice number 2, taper those treats. Practice portion control. Break treats into tiny pieces, says veterinarian Amy Addis. Pets don't measure the size of the treat. They only know they're getting one. Try fruits and vegetables. Most treats are expensive, says Gladstein. A 10-ounce bag of bacon strips cost about $6, more than a good steak at your supermarket. She suggests offering apples, bananas, and baby carrots, all good for them. Never give grapes or raisins, though. They are toxic to many animals. You could even make your own goodies. If you enjoy baking for the rest of the family, try it for your dog. Go to goodhousekeeping.com/pet for recipes. Advice number 3, save on medical care. Reach out to shelters. Most municipally run animal shelters across the country offer some type of free or low-cost spayed and neutering programs, vaccinations, and more. We spay or neuter cats for $65 and $75 for dogs, says Trey Burley in program development at Paul's Atlanta. Compare those costs with typical prices charged by vets, $90 to $200 for cats and $210 to $300 for dogs. Contact your local animal shelter or humane society to find out about available services. Scale back on vaccines. Which vaccines are necessary for your pet depends on local ordinances as well as the animal's lifestyle, age, and exposure for risk. For instance, if your pooch has no contact with other dogs, you may want to skip the kennel cough vaccine, taking $20 off your vet bill. Similarly, strict indoor-only cats may not require the feline leukemia vaccine, saving you about $25. Get the RX to go. Vets can turn a healthy profit by dispensing medicines. About 12 to 15% of a small practice's income comes from the sale of prescription meds, says veterinary Karen Felstein, CEO of the National Commission on Veterinary Economic Issues. Here's how to cut the cost. If your animal needs medication right away, get it from your vet, perhaps only a week's worth, and ask to take the prescription with you so you can order the rest online. When one of my dogs needed a new allergy medicine, recalls Cindy Lail of Georgia, I bought a 30-day supply from the vet for $17.60, but ordered the refill for $6 at Pet Care RX, that would be PetCareRx.com. Prices vary, so shop around. Or see if your vet will match the online price rather than lose business to those online retailers. Advice number 4, whittle grooming fees. Get professional grooming less often. Chances are you've spaced out your trims at the salon to save money. Share the same tactic with your pooch. If you pay $60 per grooming and cut your grooming frequency from 5 to 7 week intervals, you'll save $178 a year. Learn to give your pet a bath and a pedicure. Just taking the tip off your dog's nails weekly saves as much as $20 a month. For how-tos on bathing and clipping, ask a professional or vet. Or you can watch the videos on goodhousekeeping.com/pet. They pass muster with the vets we consulted for this article. Sick of bickering? If you two keep having the same fight, break the habit and have a much happier marriage. Almost every couple has one, that seemingly trivial fight that keeps cropping up day after day, month after month, making you feel as if you're stuck in your very own version of Groundhog Day. Perhaps it's about your husband's leaving his cereal bowl by the sink rather than the dishwasher, or you're forgetting, oops, to tell him that his mother called. The issues that trigger bickering can seem insignificant, but when fights keep on resurfacing, your otherwise happy marriage can become a petri dish of resentment and hurt feelings, the kind that leave you and your beloved sitting in different rooms watching the same TV show. I know this not only because my husband and I face our own challenges, but because as a family mediator, I counsel couples who want to work out these dumb little fights that eat their way through the quality of their life. One client, Wendy, 39, from Long Island, was fried from exactly this kind of bickering. Why is it always such a battle to get him spend an hour helping our sixth grader with his math homework? She asked. Their arguments about homework would variably seek and form into dead-end battles. You never help me with the kids. That's not true, her husband Stephen would counter. I put them to bed a lot of the time. Yes, she say. Well, that's only because I make you. Round and around they would go, adding new layers to the argument, each trying to win and prove the point, I'm right. Having the same fight over and over is, of course, pointless, but it's where many couples get stuck. Once you're deeply engaged in the battle of whose turn it was to take the clothes out of the driver, it's hard to step back. That's where mediation comes in. It requires that a husband and a wife each realize that the goal isn't to beat the adversary into submission. It's to make the fight go away. Think about it. Typically, one person's winning a fight means the other person loses. But in a marriage, the two people involved are on the same one. No matter who wins, everyone loses. When a standard bickering bout ends, one of you will have been cornered into saying, "Fine, enough, you're right," though not necessarily believing it. But neither of you will have gained a deeper understanding of the other's point of view. Beyond that, the battle loser is quite likely to have some residual anger simmering, which will wind up igniting the next fight. And that's hardly the way any of us want our couple time to unfold. So winning a war of words in marriage has to mean something entirely different, namely, finding a solution to cool off the hot button issue and resolve the fighting so it simply vanishes. I'm not saying it's easy to get past that urge to win, but I promise that trading that seething, "see, I'm right," sensation at the end of a spat for the warmth that a happy, respectful marriage has is totally worth it. Wendy and Stephen, who no longer lock horns over their son's homework, would agree. So put on your mediator's hat and follow these three guidelines. Step 1. Take a seat. At the start of your next tiff, you will probably feel the urge to wag your finger at your husband and remind him that you've told him 100 or even 1,000 times that what he just did ticks you off. But rather than pressing the point, literally keep your hands at your sides and say something like this. "Honey, can you please sit down with me now? Because I want to talk to you about something." Not only will this give you a few seconds to calm down and think before you start speaking, it will also let your partner know that the issue at hand is serious and needs to be resolved. Put the plan into action. Margot, 42, of New York, had for years been stymied about how to resolve her husband's habit of partially opening the mail when he came home from work and then leaving it on the dining table, intending to deal with it later. Since that later time never seemed to arrive, bills went unpaid, invitations went without RSVPs, and their life was a lot messier around the edges than Margot could tolerate. Usually, when Margot learned that the mail situation had led to, say, a late fee, she'd erupt and blame her husband, loudly enough for the neighbors to hear. When Margot was learning the three-step mediation strategy, she said, "The first step, sitting down and collecting my thoughts, was the hardest because when I feel angry, I want to start mouthing off. I've told him many, many times how much his procrastination with the mail bothers me, and yet he does it anyway. And that, in turn, makes me feel totally ignored and unimportant. So it seemed like lashing out at him was my only option." Margot moved past these blow-ups by recognizing that her husband's behavior was simply an annoying habit, and as such, it could be changed. "My husband is a good person, He's not the problem. It's his mail handling habit that's the problem. And habits can be broken. By taking the time to sit down and catch my breath, I was able to convince myself of the fact, stay calm, and solve the problem. Step 2. Uncover the subtext. Once you're sitting down, no matter what the conflict is, fight that impulse to blame your husband and spell out in detail where he has gone wrong. While you're at it, don't indulge that desire to say, how many times do I have to tell you this, either. Instead, act like a detective. Your goal is to figure out what your partner was thinking. You may think you know, and you may be right, or you may be completely wrong. By not making assumptions, you leave room for uncovering his actual thoughts and feelings. Ask neutral questions like, what happened? Why did you do that? And is there a reason why you weren't able to take care of it today? Speak with a calm, inquisitive tone, and if you have no idea what the answer is, work hard, and it is hard, to keep the anger, frustration, and impatience out of your voice. In most situations, each partner can speak very convincingly about his or her motives, and the what on earth was he thinking question winds up going away. Put the plan into action. Rosie of Baltimore used this technique to tackle her ongoing argument with her husband about he gives her directions when she's driving. We have a simple division of labor. When I'm at the wheel, he navigates, Rosie explains, and I want to know what the next direction is in advance. That way, I have plenty of time to switch lanes before making a turn. I also want him to give me just one direction at a time, or my brain gets overloaded. So I'll ask my husband to tell me the next turn, and he'll say, I'll tell you when we're closer. To which I say, but I need to know now. It seems like a simple enough request, but then he'll respond, why don't you just trust me? And I'll yell, why don't you just tell me? This argument drives me crazy. Though the couple had been fighting about directions for years, it wasn't until they tried the mediation techniques that they actually understood each other's behavior. By playing detective, Rosie discovered that when she asked her husband for directions well in advance of a turn, he thought she was questioning his judgment about where to go, and that really bothered him. He viewed the whole direction situation as a trust issue. I was genuinely shocked when he told me that. I had no idea he felt that way, admits Rosie. From my perspective, all I was doing was asking for some information, and all he was doing was withholding it. Once they really understood each other's viewpoints, they were able to stop getting angry and start resolving their directions dilemma. Sometimes, admittedly, there will be cases in which your spouse's motivation is exactly what you suspect it to be, and is completely infuriating. Consider the case of the couple in which the wife makes dinner and the husband is supposed to clean up the dishes, but often doesn't do so, saying, oh, I guess I got caught up watching TV, or sorry, I really had a rough day and was too tired. Tempted as the wife may be to start shouting, what do I need to do to get some help around here? Thereby escalating the situation to something approaching smackdown. Here's what needs to happen instead. The husband's explanation must be acknowledged and then used as a leverage to work out a compromise. For instance, the wife could say, I understand that you were too tired, but I didn't know that when we finished dinner. I thought the table would get cleared tonight, but now I'm seeing dirty dishes and I'm feeling upset. Can you understand that? This tactic sets the stage for the next step in the mediation process. And the point gets underscored that if you're not going to do something you said you would, you must let your wife know in advance. The third and final step. Offer solutions. This final step is the one that most couples skip when they argue about mediation techniques, and that's a key reason why they remain stuck on their bickering merry-go-round for years. Here's the agenda. You must come up with a few possible solutions. try something like, I think I understand your point of view a lot better now. Can we talk about how we can prevent this problem from cropping up again? Then suggest a specific idea and ask your partner to offer up suggestions. Getting your partner involved in the solution is a key step. Research shows that people are more likely to follow through on a plan if they feel as if they participated in creating it. Put the plan into action. Whenever Elizabeth of Dallas and her mate argued about who would empty the dishwasher, they ended up having one of those pointless scorecard battles over who did the task more often. As in often the case with chore fights, both of them would usually end up feeling as if they didn't get any credit for what they did. This time, however, Elizabeth was determined to end the argument once and for all with the three-step mediation strategy. During the final step, her husband suggested that they should take turns putting away the dishes, switching off nightly. Elizabeth suggested they swap roles every 2 days and post a checkoff chart on the fridge. Neither option struck me as a perfect solution, she said, but then my husband came up with a nice compromise. We would each be responsible for clearing the table and emptying the dishwasher for a full week, changing roles every Monday. That felt like a much less complicated plan, one we could easily live with. We've been following it for 3 months now and haven't had a single fight over it, which has made married life a lot sweeter. And the bonus is, we feel that if a new crop of here it comes again arguments come up, we'll know how to handle it. Recurring quarrels about apparently trivial matters can sometimes mean that there are deeper issues swirling that are too big or too scary to tackle head on. The fight about dirty plates left on the table might really reflect, say, a power struggle in the marriage. Regardless of the real issue, the three-step mediation process gives you a technique to handle the conflict and start chipping away at the problem. If you try this technique in good faith and it doesn't take the quarreling down a notch or two, it's probably time to seek professional counseling. This article was by family lawyer and mediator Laurie Punn. She's the author of Instant Persuasions, How to Change Your Words to Change Your Life. Our next section is the Ask Peggy by Peggy Post. The question is, my friend always gives me unsolicited advice on diet, career, family, you name it. How can I tell her this bothers me without hurting her feelings? Here's Peggy's answer. Think about the tone of your recent conversations. If you've been airing complaints, she may feel obliged to offer solutions. Next time you might say, thanks for listening, I just needed to vent. If she doesn't get the hint, speak up. I know you're trying to help, but I'm really okay. Then change the subject, perhaps by asking her what she's been up to. Our next question. I can't stand it when people whisper in a movie theater. It's distracting and rude. How do I shush their sound? The answer. There's nothing impolite about issuing one shh or a calm request of a good, could you please keep it down, thanks, in a place where quiet is expected. You could also go get the manager, but you'd miss part of the show, and your departure and return might disturb others. Another obvious, if annoying, option, move to another seat far from the noisemakers. Question. Should you stand firm on formality? Your daughter's friend calls you by your first name, even though you've asked her to use Mrs. Should you bring the matter up with her parents? Peggy says no, at least not at first. Politely remind her a few more times. If that doesn't work, speak to her parents if you know them well. Say, in spite of these casual times, I like kids to use my last name. I'm not criticizing you or your daughter. It's just my preference. Question. Your work review was good, but you didn't get a raise. You think you deserved one. What should you do? Peggy says, talk with your boss calmly and respectably about company raise policy. If she says nobody's getting salary increases now, ask for a re-evaluation in 3 months when things may have improved. And if you like compensatory time off, put on that on the table as well. Words to Love By. My grandmother told me what happy wives know. Almost exactly 8 years ago, I announced my engagement to my now husband, Marcus. Soon after that day, while I was in Trinidad visiting family, my grandmother, who was 95 at the time, pulled me aside. Karen, she said in a soft voice, you realize that as a good wife, you should always make sure your husband looks good. Iron his clothes and lay them out for him every day. Make him a good breakfast every morning. But there's one thing you must never forget, she said, leaning toward me. You must never shine a man's shoes. I smiled with affection whenever I think of that day, for as long as I can remember, until she died peacefully this year at age 102, my grandmother spoke to me about love and relationships, and though much of what she said seemed a bit outdated, I don't believe I've ever ironed my husband's dress shirts, I found a kernel of wisdom in all that she ever told me. Make your husband feel loved and cared for, but don't let him think that you are his servant or that you are in any way beneath him. When I was a teenager, I lived with my grandmother for a couple of years. I cherished those quiet moments when we'd sit and enjoy guava cheese, her weakness, as we talked about my future and what it had been like to date my grandfather, and how much more valuable happiness, family, and friendships were than money. I remember watching her pay the man who helped tend her garden. Afterwards, she'd invite him to help himself to as many of the mangoes or avocados on her trees as he could carry to take home to his family. If there's one woman who truly went out of her way to show me what love should be, it was my grandmother. Now that I'm a mother myself, I do my best to recreate those moments with my own daughter. She's only 5, but even now while we snuggle in bed, as we do every morning, I talk to her about how her friends should treat her and how she should treat her friends. I talk to her about what I hope for her when she grows up and decides to have her own family. I tell her stories about how her father and I met and how much we love each other. I tell her how I felt the first time I saw her tiny face in the hospital. When we're out and about, I often try to do something nice for a stranger. Something simple, like a smile, or hold the door open, or buy coffee for the person behind me in line, just so she sees that love can indeed be all around. One day, I might even tell her about a man's shoes. That article was by blogger Karen Walround. Karen lives in Houston with her husband and daughter. Visit her blog at chookoolonks.com. Ask our expert, should I switch my home phone to an internet-based service? A VOIP, a voice-over-internet protocol, phone services work by transmitting sound over a high-speed internet connection. You get a regular phone number and dial or receive calls just as with a landline. The appeal, VOIP plans can offer unlimited calling and have special features, but 911 calls may not be included, so do your research. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode from Soups to Nut. I have been reading from the September issue of Good Housekeeping Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time.